Yeah. I'm done with the place. Did you bring
We're remodeling. Is it closed? Okay, now I have to do this.
It's going to take them so long to deliver the issue, so last time.
They're going to use that. Hope we charge the pack of people the dishes.
Thousands. We're starting, Joyce. We're starting. We're starting. Give me a sec.
My internal talk just get to it.
Okay. Gail, is David coming? No pressure, just a.
Somewhere in the building working on financial statements.
So he didn't want to stop that excitement for. There's no pressure. I just would have waited for him if he was coming. I know, I saw him when he came in. It's not nice to laugh, but it's a little funny. Okay. Good evening, all. Just for those of you who are at home, I sort of recalibrated how I'm sitting now, so it's a little kind of have to reorient myself. But we have very nice new bookcases here behind me in the lobby area, and so look forward to seeing it if you haven't seen it yet in Shul. So this evening we're going to be speaking about the recent Alabama Supreme Court decision. People know what the decision was? People familiar at all with what I'm talking about? Yes? Anyone want to say what happens? Who may know better than I do?
Married as all the rights of black children.
Okay, good. Right. So there was basically the long story short was that you had this fertility clinic who had these frozen embryos, something happened. They dropped them, and they were then disposed of because they were contaminated. And the parents, the people who were the quote unquote owners of the embryos, they sued, and the lawsuit was brought basically as if they murdered these children who were just embryos. And one court, I think the lower court. Originally ruled against them and said that this was not a case of murder, but then it went to the Alabama Supreme Court, and the Alabama Supreme Court said that the fertility agency were indeed liable for murder, for murdering these little frozen embryos. And as a result, it sort of created this major firestorm that many of the clinics throughout the state of Alabama that were involved in IVF essentially all shut down because no one wanted to be involved in this because no one wanted to be tried for murder at the expense of potentially, it does happen every now and again that either sometimes you accidentally throw out embryos when you are done with them if a family is done with whatever treatments they were going for, or in times where you may decide that this is going to be something that you are finished with. So if you throw it out, then that could be liable to murder. So no one wants to deal with this stuff anymore. And so therefore the whole state of Alabama went crazy. And this, of course, became very political because it was tied into the whole Roe v. Wade, the overturning of Roe v. Wade that happened a few months ago or whenever that was. So the question that I want to deal with this evening is just a pretty simple question, but as we'll see, of course, it's a little bit more complex as we will move further. But it's the question of the Jewish perspective of IVF, right? So in Judaism, what do we believe about IVF in terms of its permissibility? And as we'll see, some perspectives will probably be shocking because for those who are a little bit familiar with modern day IVF treatments, and certainly within the Orthodox community, IVF is something that is practiced widely for those who do need it. And so we will see some perspectives that are, again, very anti-IVF. And more than that, try to understand that if this was a Beit Din that was ruling, what would the Beit Din have decided regarding this attempted murder of these embryos? Would they have decided, yes, it is indeed attempted murder according to Jewish law, or no, it's not attempted murder, and in fact, it was just the killing or the throwing out, the disposing of a few cells that, okay, it's very tragic, very sad for a family who was trying to do something with them, who may not even have many of them. But beyond that, there's nothing really else to talk about. Perhaps they have financial damages, but not to be tried for a murder. So that is our question, those two questions, essentially. So I had the first source over here sort of explaining what was going on, but I don't think we have to do that. So let's jump right in. There are two sources that you'll see in front of you. So these two sources, you may remember from one of the early... Oh, so this is very weird now. You guys have to look that way. Oh, interesting. All right, we'll have to figure it out. So there are two sources that you may remember from all the way back when we spoke about abortion. I have no idea how long ago that was, but we spoke about abortion several months ago, sometime last year. So there are two relevant sources to this topic as well, and it's essentially the question of when exactly does life begin, right? So if life begins at conception, essentially when the egg is fertilized, then that would mean that the Jewish view of these embryos would basically be murder if they were to be killed, if that is indeed when life begins. But if it's the opposite, if Judaism views that life begins when the baby comes out of the womb, so then we will know and understand quite clearly that the embryo itself has no real significance of life, and therefore, again, sad that they were disposed of, but not actually murder. So essentially, we have two contradictory sources over here that each seem to imply one of these two different perspectives. So if you take a look first in the Mishnah in Ohalos, so the Mishnah says, if a woman is having trouble giving birth, so what are they do? They cut up the child in her womb and this and bring it forth limb by limb, because her life comes before the life of the child. But if the greater part has come out, one may not touch this child, for one may not set aside one person's life for that of another. So according to this Mishnah, what would we say? Life begins at birth, not a conception. And before, when conception happens, it's just a grouping of cells, and it's really only at birth, when the baby starts to come out of the womb, that's when it takes its first breath, and that's when it's alive, and that's when you can't all of a sudden push away that life for the mom's life, because you have life versus life. Before that, you don't have life versus life. If you take a look, however, in source number three, so there's a Mishnah in Yoma, in which we're told something that would appear to be the contrary. So with regard to a pregnant woman who smelled food and was overcome by a craving to eat it, one feeds her until she recovers, as failure to do so could lead to a life-threatening situation. If a person is ill and requires food due to a potential danger, one feeds him according to the advice of medical experts who determine that he indeed requires food. And if there are no experts there, one feeds him according to his own instructions until he says that he has eaten enough and needs no more. Right? So we're talking about the case of someone who finds themselves on Yom Kippur, who is technically unable to be eating, but and again, technically a pregnant woman is supposed to be fasting, assuming everything is normal and healthy with her, should be fasting on Yom Kippur. But let's say she has this incredible craving. So says the Mishnah, she could actually go ahead and eat food, because we're concerned that if she does not eat food, then this could lead to a life-threatening situation. Now, there are two different possibilities of whose life we're concerned of. Who... Option A would be the mother. Option B would be the fetus, right? So some want to go ahead and say that the interpretation of this Mishnah is actually very clearly talking about the fetus, because of course this wouldn't lead to a life or death situation for the mother herself, right? Again, most people have fasted, before in their lives. And so it seems like the life that we're talking about, concerned that we may be losing over here, is that of the fetus. And if we're concerned of the light of the fetus, that would seem to imply that we do believe that life begins while the baby is in the womb. And since the Mishnah does not go ahead and spell out any further as to what point of the pregnancy we're talking about, we could assume this is any part of the pregnancy. And so therefore, essentially, the implication of this Mishnah would be that life begins at conception. So here we have... One moment, I see you're upset. Here we see two very contradictory Mishnayot, one that will imply that life begins at conception, one that believes that life will begin at birth. Yeah, Joyce.
Very easily be a life-threatening condition to the mother if she has gestational diabetes, which they may not have known about back then.
Okay, good. Fantastic.
Something that she really must do to preserve herself.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So you're 100% correct that you may absolutely have every right to interpret this Mishnah as talking about a life-threatening situation for the woman. However, there are a number of commentaries who assume that while that may be true, it's clear that the life-threatening situation that we're talking about over here is the fetus. So in other words, not to say that you're wrong, but the life that we're concerned of most over here in this moment is that of the baby. Perhaps the explanation would be that it's not that we're not concerned about the mother, but it's that the chiddush, right, the sort of insight that the Mishnah is offering is that not only are we concerned about the mother, but we're also concerned about the fetus. But you're right. In essence, you could interpret this Mishnah to not contradict, but there are those who interpret it to contradict. So, yeah. Good? Someone? All right, you'll accept that. All right. So it's okay, I have all these books behind me, so I look very smart now. So with that being said, sort of that as the preface of the entire conversation, understanding that as far as Judaism is concerned, you really can find sources either way. And as you'll remember, as we studied way back when we did learn about abortion, that there are numerous circumstances where Judaism will allow abortion and numerous circumstances where Judaism will not allow abortion, right? And so it's clear that there is, according to Jewish law, some value of significance to the fetus, as to what extent we might assume that, such that if you do have someone growing cells together in a petri dish, so do you assume that there is a real child there? So again, you can go back and forth, but you would imagine that in all likelihood, if this was brought to a Jewish Beit Din and not to just the Alabama Supreme Court, but someone who was going according to the Jewish sources, there's a lot of likelihood to say that they would not have assumed that this was actually murder. And there are multiple reasons why you would come to that conclusion. But in all likelihood, that would probably be what Jewish law would state. What is interesting, though, is trying to get to the bottom of understanding if IVF is permissible. And so you'll say, of course it's permissible. It enables people to have children. Well, so let's play devil's advocate for a second. Why would IVF potentially not be something that we would allow in Judaism?
So, obviously, no fetus survives.
What do you mean by that? Okay, so Anne is saying that there's a concern that if a person goes for IVF treatments, especially the person might likely be in this situation because they struggle with fertility, so there's a strong likelihood that none of these fetuses will be viable inside the woman, and so therefore you can't even try, perhaps.
Sick.
Okay, good. Got a potential danger to her, okay, yeah, right.
IVF, they don't just take one embryo, one cell. They take a whole bunch of ones. And then they fertilize them all. If one plants successfully, sometime at that point, the rest are destroyed. Well, if you argue that's destruction, sure.
Okay, good. Oh, fantastic. So what Ray brings up now is what we call hashchasa zera, that there is a prohibition to destroy sperm. And so, therefore, if a person allows for this a whole grouping of embryos and sperm, that some of it will get thrown out or the like, then perhaps that would fall into numerous Torah prohibitions. One would be Ashchasa Zara. Another would be the potential of just destroying whatever type of life we do have here. Okay, good. Gail, you were going to say something?
End of IVF is almost, it's rare to that the intent is to use all of the fertilized eggs. Often they're sorted, or there's more that could possibly be implanted. So the whole procedure assumes that you intend to not allow some of them to survive.
Okay, all right, fantastic. Right.
It's not accidental.
Right, right. So, okay, so 100%, right? So there definitely is an element of IVF that I don't know exactly certainly don't know how the science works, but I don't know exactly what the protocols are, but they take a whole grouping of eggs and a quantity of sperm, and they try to fertilize as much as they can, I believe, to make sure that they can try to get something. And so the likelihood, right, there was that case a number of years ago, the Octo Mom, right? Who she was a fun person to deal with, right? So she, I think, had some sort of IVF or something like that, and she had a whole grouping of fertilized eggs implanted in her, and turns out that a lot of them took, and so she had 8 babies, right? So, but still, In most cases, you are going to take a whole grouping of eggs and a whole grouping of sperm as much as possible that is viable, and you are going to likely not implant all of them, but you will implant some of them. And so that means that in all likelihood, the rest, if there are left over, so you will probably have to dispose of that. And so since that's an inevitability of the process, even if you want to say that there are many situations where we might be lenient when it comes to not assuming that there is life at conception, to go into it knowing that you're going to destroy it, so that could be very problematic. Did you want to say something?
Going back to Ray's point about the prohibition against destruction of sperm, which would absolutely be part of the IVF process, because the sperm is washed and only the good guys, only the
strong ones.
Right.
Okay. Good. Fantastic. And I'll even add to Ray's point as well. And it's interesting that no one brought this up, but who's to say that it's permissible even to be involved in the act of masturbation to retrieve the sperm to begin with, right? So every yeshiva boy is scarred by learning that there is a tremendous Torah prohibition of masturbation in general. So you'll say, okay, here there is a, let's be honest here. So there is a little bit of practical. There is a little bit of practicality over here, of course, where the sperm is going to, but just to be involved in the act, who's to say that even the action itself is permissible? And so therefore, that might also be a concern. So for all of these reasons, and then some, so there is the Shut Sitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Woldenberg, one of the contemporary rabbis of the 20th century, who has this very, very long teshuva, in which we summarize briefly in English over here, and take a look at what he says, because it's quite shocking. Again, this is going to be the most stringent opinion we're going to note tonight, and I'll just say at the beginning, spoiler alert, we do not follow this opinion, but it's worthwhile and important to know that it is out there. So Rav Eliezer Woldenberg objected to the entire procedure of IVF. Rav Woldenberg argues that whenever the fertilization fails, the husband has ejaculated to waste. Even when one sperm cell does fertilize the egg, Rav Woldenberg notes that the rest of the semen goes to waste. And this is quite shocking. Rav Woldenberg further claims that one does not fulfill the mitzvah of having children on any level through IVF, right? So in other words, if a person is going to have a sexual relationship with a woman and they have a child, so that, of course, will be a fulfillment of pru urvu, of having children. But if you are doing it through IVF, through a test tube, petri dish, whatever it is, that's not clearly the normal derech hateva. That's not through nature. And so therefore, it says Rav Woldenberg, you can't even fulfill the obligation of procreation through this, so what's the point? Thus, he writes, what does one gain by presenting a way to create children in this manner? If the creators of the child will not fulfill any divine command, and the practice of IVF will create profound and complex problems, which have the potential to cause the level of human morality to deteriorate more than 1,000-fold. Larry, I see your hand. I'll get you in a second. Rav Woldenberg expresses particular concern that IVF will lead to cloning, which he deems an utter abomination because, all right, Larry, enough. because it could distort the human character. But most halachic authorities do reject Rav Woldenberg's approach, as we will soon see. But first, we will address Larry's faces.
To the beginning, Eric, stop, come up with a pen. The rest of the sperm go to waste. That happens in any case. In the natural process, only one. Oh. Waste.
Okay. Okay, good. So a fantastic question, Larry. And I'm assuming we don't need it to have a... Sorry? Yeah, so it was a good question, Larry. So I'm assuming we don't need to have a sex ed class and everyone understands what Larry is referring to, hopefully. If not, see Larry afterwards. But it's basically the approach that the rabbis take to it is that when a man and a woman are having sex together and the semen of the man goes into the woman, then even though, of course, only one is going to be used at the end of the day for this purpose, then we're not concerned about wasting the seed. But specifically when it's outside of the human body and then you are going to basically be picking and choosing, so that's when Rav Woldenberg was concerned. Less faces? Okay, good. But so this is the approach of the Tzitz Eliezer. Again, very famous because of the tremendous stringency over here. It's noteworthy to point out that a lot of this is based on the fact of his sincere concerns with cloning, which is, of course, where at least an area of the science has gone towards. It's obviously much more taboo, and certainly even in the year 2024, this is not something that is quite prevalent, and we are years away from that. But there are scientists out there who due to the innovation of fertility treatments, also now know how to be involved in science of cloning and the like. And so you can't say they're totally disconnected, but it is worthwhile to note that that is really where a tremendous concern, or at least part of it, comes from for the Tzitz Eliezer's decision to be stringent over here. Okay, with that aside, there are, of course, the majority of poskim who are lenient and, in fact, encouraging of this process because, again, there are, unfortunately, not many couples who cannot have kids who IVF has saved them and allowed them to have children. So let's take, for example, first, in source number 5, Rav Avadya Yosef. So Chacham Avadya Yosef was, of course, one of the Sephardic chief rabbis of Israel and one of the greatest gedolim of the 20th century. And he says as follows. He says, Maskana, this is just the conclusion. He also has a very, very lengthy tshuva. But he says, I apologize, we'll read the Hebrew and translate it. Maskana didina legabi tinok mavchana shenira shedino shave lemashi tira achronim la tira zraka zera haba l'rechem aisha. Right, so there is this comparison that one can make that if a person is going to do something like IVF, it's in many ways very similar to some of the cases that we have in the Gemara. That kishe'ef shar b'shum panim liisha lahachnis leherayon b'ofen acher, if a woman cannot become pregnant in any other way, kederach kol ha'aretz, like the rest of the world, then of course this is permissible. Worthwhile to note that, you know, certainly in the world that we live in nowadays with CRISPR and gene modification and things like that, people who like to be able to customize their children and the like, which is, of course, a growing fad. So that's something that Judaism is not super fond of, because if we believe, if there is a way to do things in the natural order, we do like to do things in the natural order. But again, if a person has no other options, or this seems to be a very prevalent option, then Rav Avadya Yosef says, absolutely, this is something that a person should go ahead and do. But he does point out, one has to be very careful, right? So we need a mashkiach in a kitchen. So too, we need a mashkiach in this situation, right? Because there could be mixing or something like that. The faces tonight. V'tzarech lashkiach meod shelo yuchlaf zera habal b'zera shel eish acher. We don't want to go ahead and mix the sperm of one man and another. There's a lot of jokes you can make here, but we'll keep it PG or G rated tonight. Uma tov shehiyeh hadavar al yedei shnei rofim datiyim b'hashkacha melea mishah sotza zazera an hachnasaso letoch harechem. And he says, ideally, if it is possible, a person should go ahead and employ doctors who are Orthodox Jews to do this process on an ideal level. Of course, it does not exist. It's not something that you have to drive yourself crazy over. But he says that it's ideal because, again, the implications are quite severe if so there would be a mess up. And we like to go ahead and try to eliminate any sort of halachic mess ups whatsoever. Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. Oversight.
Yeah.
And actually taking note to the general world because of intentional hiccups.
What does that mean?
There have been a number of reports between OBGYNs who have substituted their own sperm.
Yeah.
And IVF.
Intentional for what? Intention. What's the purpose?
To guarantee it, because he needs squirrels, so he wanted to guarantee it.
Wow. I tell you, there's lots of kinds of people in this world. Really? So people do this intentionally, and so it's good.
Us or not, there was a report of one particular GYN who has some like 33 children.
Wow, like Genghis Khan. Wow. Okay.
But there's also that one that was on Dateline, whatever.
Oh, my grand over
200 children. Wow. Like the Mormons.
Well, except for the fact that they all.
I understand. They have reunions? Really?
Some of them have dated their half siblings.
Oh, my gosh. They both had the same eyes and they loved it. And
two of the cases that I've read about, there were genetic issues in the father.
That's how so
they happened. Some of them have medical issues. Yeah. So what the mother thought she was getting.
Okay.
Some of them thought that that it was actually going to be their husband's child.
Okay.
But they certainly didn't get what they thought they were getting.
Okay. Well, okay, fine. So thank you for making the point even more clearly. Yeah, this was knowledge I did not need to know, but I'm so glad I know now. Evidently, in case you didn't hear in the Zoom world, there are numerous cases of crazy OBGYNs who decide to use their own sperm or other types of mix-up like that that evidently take place on purpose. And so therefore, all the more so, this idea of having a mashkiach makes a lot of sense. And it's clear that because there's so much of a concern for mix-up, so one should do whatever they can to involve oversight in this process. And he says, "V'ra'iti lemisha kasav l'chalek v'la'asor." He says, "I've seen those out there who have prohibited this practice, namely the Tzitz Eliezer. V'lo matzasi yiso nachon l'chalek b'zeh. V'achar kach shamati shekin atziru kama gedolam b'dorinu v'Hashem yisbarach ya'ir einino b'torah kedosha. Amen." So he says, at first when I saw those who said that it wasn't allowed, it sounded sound, and I didn't want to disagree with them. But then he says, I heard of many others who did permit it, and he attributes this to Hashem enlightening his eyes in the Torah, and he's so happy that he was enlightened, and so it is permissible, according to Rav Avadya Yosef, to go ahead and be involved in IVF. Now, there are numerous other opinions who permit it as well. I sort of have a synopsis over here. So Rabbi Jachter in Gray Matter, which is, we've quoted it in the past in this class, but it's basically, he has lots of different contemporary essays, and he says as follows, Rav Yosef Shalom al-Yashiv also permits IVF when the wife's eggs are used, but not when using the egg of another woman. He insists on supervision of the IVF process to ensure that only the genetic material of the husband and wife are used. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach adds that an infertile couple is not obligated to undergo IVF in order to have children. Right, so it's worthwhile to note. So if we're saying that IVF is a tenable solution for a couple who's not able to have children, well, let's say a couple is not able to have children, are they obligated, because they're obligated in procreation, are they obligated to try? And so he says, no, you're not obligated to do that much, but if you do it, of course, they will be your children and a fulfillment of that mitzvah. And although most authorities do not fundamentally object to IVF, at least for married couples, several major problems do arise during IVF procedures, including procuring the husband's sperm in a halachically acceptable manner, the permissibility of paying a woman to donate an ovum if one's rav permits using a donated ovum, and concern for the possible mamzeret, illegitimate status of the donor, if permitted, and the credibility of a non-observant or non-Jewish doctor's assertion that he used the sperm and or ovum of a particular person, perhaps maybe not in Rochester, to have a general concern as to whether or not the doctor is going to be fully honest. Now, essentially, it is worthwhile to note as well that if this process is to be done, there are a number of concerns that the rest of the world does not necessarily have nowadays as much as we do. So one of the big ones, for example, is if you have a Jewish male who is going to have a child, and then you take an egg from a non-Jewish woman or a Jewish woman, assume either case, and you have a surrogate mother, let's say, who carries a baby, that's sort of an additional layer over here. So there are major complications as to the Jewishness of the baby. So basically, the question comes down to is, what will determine the motherhood of the baby? Does the egg, is you have to have a Jewish egg, or you have to have a Jewish birth? That's really the question. And lest you say that Chazal never spoke about this, you'd be totally wrong, because Chazal do have this concept brought up, and it's basically, as you could understand, the source of a bit of a dispute. But it's based on the following fascinating scenario that took place in the times of our forefathers, because we know that there were a lot of different stories that were told and explanations that were given in terms of Rachel Imenu and Leah Imenu having children. right? Leah ends up having a lot of sons. Rachel does not have too many sons. She only has two in the end. And so there are those who explain that originally Dina was meant to be born to Rachel Imenu, such that she, right, so she does have two sons, but originally it was supposed to be that she was supposed to have one son and one daughter. And then Leah would then have gotten the extra son. So there are those who explain that it was actually a child that Dina and Yosef, that those that those fetuses were switched in utero. Again, the scientific reality of this is not something we're going to talk about now, but that they were, however Hashem made it work, that they were switched while they were in the womb. And if they were switched while they were in the womb, well, so then that would change how we would interpret who the mother is based on, how are the financial reports? That would determine how a person would go ahead and view the motherhood status, right? So let's take a look now in source number 7. So the Targum Yonatan on Bereishis says as follows. So the Targum Yonatan was, of course, a Aramaic translation, but also offers a commentary on the text. So here's what he says. And afterward, she bare a daughter and called her name Dina. This is Leah. For she said, judgment is from before the Lord, that there shall be from me a half of the tribes, but from Rachel, my sister, shall go forth two tribes, even as they shall proceed in like manner from each of the handmaids. And the prayer of Leah was heard before the Lord, and the infants were changed in their wombs, and Joseph was given to the womb of Rachel and Dina to the womb of Leah. Right? So if we believed that motherhood started at conception, meaning from the egg, who should have been the real mother of Yosef? Leah should have been the real mother, because according to this, it was from her egg. But who do we assume is the mother at the end of the day? Rachel Imenu. And therefore, how would you interpret this of where motherhood starts? That what defines motherhood? The birth, right? So that would be one perspective over here. But then, of course, there is another perspective out there. And so take a look at source number 8 from Zalman Nehemiah Goldberg, who offers the strongest proof for those who define motherhood by giving birth. He cites a passage. So this is just a further proof. He cites a passage from the Gemara that discusses a non-Jewish woman who conceived twins and converted during her pregnancy. The Gemara considers the babies to be half-brothers on their mother's side. If the mother-son relationship between the woman and her twins had begun at the time of conception, her subsequent conversion would have terminated it based on the principle of Ger Shenet Gayer Kikatan Shenola Dami, that a convert is like a newborn baby, so he is no longer related to his original family. Accordingly, if the Gemara rules that this woman is related to her twins, the mother-son relationship must have come into existence only after her conversion. And we must hence conclude that birth and not conception confers the status of motherhood, right? So that is this, again, one perspective over here. But now let's take a look at the opposite perspective. So if we take a look in source number 9, the Torah Aruch, in his commentary on the Torah. So there is a very interesting marriage that seems to take place. Let's take a look inside. So Ibn Ezra explains, so there was this person known as Shaul the Canaanite, the son of the Canaanite. So Ibn Ezra explains this puzzling statement by saying that this grandson of Yaakov was the only one born by a Canaanite mother, as none of his other sons married girls of Canaanite parentage. Rashi explains the phenomenon as an allusion to this Shaul being a son of Dina, who had been raped by the Canaanite Shechem, right? So there's this sort of this unknown person who is attributed as the son of Shimon, okay, which is not right over here, but that's the context of the Torah. And the understanding would be that Shimon married a Canaanite woman, and therefore there was the only son born from a Canaanite woman of any of the tribes. But says Rashi, that's not the case. It wasn't from a Canaanite woman. It was actually from Dina, who was raped by a Canaanite person from the city of Shechem. If so, we are confronted with another difficulty. How could Shimon marry a sister by his own mother, right? So Shimon would essentially have had a child with his sister Dina. How could that be okay? So according to a Medrash, the problem is resolved, and it is presumed that Dina's fetus grew predominantly in Rachel's womb, right? And so essentially, according to this, if Dina was formed in the womb of Rachel Imenu, and she is not going to be considered a sister of Shimon, even though they both had the same birth mother, what does that mean? How is motherhood decided? What decides it? Conception, right? Because Dina was conceived by another mother, and therefore if we're going to assume this as the reality, then that would mean that a motherhood is defined by conception, and so therefore that's how one would decide it. So ultimately it becomes very complicated, and because of these concerns, that is why there was a lot of trepidation when the poskim did allow IVF, not to say that it shouldn't be done, but because of these concerns, it sort of raised this immediate red flag of, okay, we have to be careful here, because if you're not careful enough, you could end up with all these questions. And indeed, I'm not sure if it's more common in Rochester than in other areas, reason number whatever to move to Rochester, there have been a number of cases of surrogacy that I have personally had connections to. There was just this past week someone from down in New York who came up, who I know from a previous life, who is a single man who just had a baby through surrogacy. And again, I don't know if it's more common here or what, but it is, I learned, a very big an easy way to make some cash if you decide to become a surrogate mom. And so there are all these halachic questions of if the woman isn't Jewish, if the egg donor isn't Jewish. And so that's really the source for all this concern with IVF. But again, in many cases, IVF is talking about typically, as much as possible, if you have, in the context of marriage, a couple who's struggling to have children. And so it's a husband and wife who are hopefully using the woman's egg if it is viable, and they use the woman's womb if it is viable as well. And so those most poskim have no concerns of whatsoever. If you take a look now in source number 10, Rabbi Jachter again says that a number of other major issues emerge from the process of IVF. For example, authorities discuss the propriety of discarding fertilized eggs that are not transferred into a womb, or using them for medical research. Rav Zalman Nechemia told me that he believes a fertilized egg does not have the status of a human life. Let's skip that for a second. This is the italics. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu forbids this. Let's skip that too. He explained that an act must occur in order for the fertilized egg to develop. So its status differs from fertilized ova in the mother's womb, which developed independently. Rav Gidon Weitzman similarly reported that many posts can permit discarding unused frozen embryos. Interestingly, the Rabbinical Council of America and the Orthodox Union jointly sent a carefully worded letter to President George W. Bush endorsing embryonic stem cell research on existing embryos, such as those created for the purpose of IVF, that would otherwise be discarded. IVF often results in a woman carrying many fetuses at once. In many cases, all of the fetuses will die if some of them are not eliminated. And so essentially what... Okay, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Yashiv reportedly permit producing children through IVF so that doctors can inspect the sperms and eggs' genetic makeup to verify that they are free of genetic flaws. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach questions whether a boy conceived through artificial insemination should have his Brit Milah on Shabbat. Okay, Rav Schechter ruled in practice against circumcising such a baby on Shabbat. And Rav Bleich asserts that the same applies to a child who is conceived through IVF. However, Rav Avadji Yosef permits circumcising a baby conceived through artificial insemination or IVF on Shabbat. And okay, parents should ask their local Orthodox rabbi. Okay, so essentially what we have over here is that there is a bit of a shift in, once you assume that a baby could be created through IVF or even through artificial insemination, when things are, again, a little bit different than what we call the regular derech hateva, through regular natural through natural actions. And so as a result, so by the way, not to say that, God forbid, IVF or artificial insemination is not natural, but in other words, through what we call the Derech HaTeva. Perhaps there's not a really good English translation for that. But ultimately, we see that there is this question out there as to what the halachic implications are of a fetus like this, in that can the circumcision take place on Shabbos or not? Because we believe that for a circumcision in a quote-unquote regular situation, you are allowed to push Shabbos away so that you can go ahead and perform the bris milah. But perhaps if it wasn't done in, again, the quote-unquote most normal way, then maybe you would not be allowed. So that's what the poskim are going back and forth about over here. But ultimately, we see very clearly that not only is IVF allowed according to most, but even the destruction or throwing out or using for other purposes of these fertilized eggs or the like would be permissible, because we don't assume that they have much of a status of life. It's only when there would be in the context of, okay, you're using them for actual procreation right now, but if they are not used and they're never going to be used, then they don't have that same level of sanctity of life. Now, where this really came into play was a fascinating reality, and with this case, we'll conclude. There was a fascinating case that took place in Israel a number of years ago, and we had the following situation. There was, I believe it was a fertility clinic that had a whole bunch of freezers that were holding fertilized eggs, embryos, in their freezers, and all of a sudden, on Shabbos, the power went out. And so all of the freezers, as a result, went out as well, which meant that all of these embryos are now going to quote-unquote die, right? And so therefore, this major halakhic question became, are you allowed to go ahead and violate Shabbos in order to save them? You say, well, what do you mean? Don't they have a generator? Yes, they did have a generator. The problem is that generator needed to be activated, and the activation of that generator would require someone to totally violate Shabbos. And so the question was, is that allowed? Can one go ahead and violate Shabbos in order to save these fertilized eggs? So we take a look first. There's a statement from the Rush, quoting the Ramban back in the Middle Ages, and he says, because of a Ramban, Zal, Mashma mitoch divrei bal halachos demishum sakanas vlad l'chudei mechalalin. So he says something amazing. If there is a danger for the fetus on Shabbos, you have a pregnant woman who is in danger on Shabbos, and the baby is in danger, you can violate Shabbos for that baby. Case in point, God forbid you have a pregnant woman who all of a sudden feels very sick on Shabbos, something that she feels is not right, you take her to the hospital, because you're allowed to break Shabbos in order to save that baby. So you would immediately assume, therefore, that if you apply that logic for one fetus, then of course, if you have an entire several freezerfuls, you would apply that as well. However, that's not what they ended up deciding. If you take a look in source number 12 in the Shut Shevet HaLevi, Rav Vuzner was asked this question, and he said he had this terrible conundrum that he ran into. What was the conundrum that he might have run into? Why would he not want to save all of these embryos over here? Say, of course he should save the embryos. Okay, good. But think more relevant to our case. Why would Rav Uzner not want to rule to be able to violate Shabbos for these embryos? What would he basically be saying about these embryos? That they're people. And what would have happened if he would have ruled that? Alabama. So all of a sudden, he was really stuck between a rock and a hard place, because if he would rule that all of these embryos are basically like human life, and therefore you could violate Shabbos in order to save them, like what was this accepted practice based on what the Ramban quoted above, so all of a sudden you're going to assume that any single time you have an embryo in an IVF clinic, they're all going to be real lives, and any sort of disposal of them, any sort of destruction of them will be prohibited because it's human life. And so this was his Alabama moment. You see that even Alabama already happened, and he ruled My Rebbe always says, every chumra leads to a kula, every stringency leads to a leniency. So he ruled very stringently over here because of the potential concerns of what the ramifications might be. And so therefore, let's read it inside and we'll translate. Ledati baror de gam lebahag asur lechal Shabbos bazeh. He says, even according to the opinion that we just quoted that says you could push Shabbos aside for that one instance, for this case, he says he would agree with me not to allow it. Dal korchach lo hitir bahag lechal Shabbos ala ubarin afilu lifnei mem yom afal gav demaya ba'almahu ala ba'ubar toch me. Right, so as Sam said, all right, the reason why the Bahag did allow it to begin with was because it was within the womb of a woman, and so it's. But if the Bahag, that's the opinion that was quoted above, if he would have seen this fertilized egg in a petri dish, he would not have agreed. The afal gav de tam v'chay behem adayin leka mikol makom had de paskina nalav shemutar lechal Shabbos gam zenimne al yisod shehiyu al kolpanim achar kach. He says that the psak that was given many hundreds of years ago was based on the reality that most pregnant women, when they do have that baby in their womb, they will, God willing, be able to carry that baby to fruition and be able to give birth. So since most women will be able to give birth, so we assume you could be mechallel Shabbos on the likelihood that a baby will be born. But over here, you have a freezer full of thousands of embryos that are fertilized. It's not the case. Not most of them are going to be saved. A tremendous amount of them will be thrown out. And so therefore, Masha ain't kein zera zeh, it's not the case with all of these eggs and these the sperm over here. Shebetoch hamevchana she'ilu nechlal klal barov zeh derov haubarim b'nei kayamahim debochnem rak mibachutz eichiyah. He says, so it's clearly not the case over here that there most of them are going to be real viable babies that will be used, and so therefore he was very stringent over here, and he ruled against the Supreme Court of Alabama before there even was the ruling of the Supreme Court of Alabama. And basically what we're left with over here is I think something very profound, that Judaism is incredibly sensitive when it comes to these matters, that when it comes to the let's call it for these conversations, the most simple of cases, you have a couple who is unfortunately struggling to have kids, so the poskim are beyond lenient and do whatever they can to allow them to have children as much as possible. But on the flip side of things, when it comes to a case like the Alabama Supreme Court situation, we are not as gung-ho about assuming that these little embryos are going to be fertilized and therefore considered like human life because of the other terrible implications, as we see, it can now cause. And so the poskim are very sensitive sort of across the board depending on the situation at hand. And so ultimately I hope this gives us a little bit more of an insight, A, into the Jewish perspective, but also B, into the incredible sensitivity of our rabbis throughout Jewish history. And I'm happy to take any questions, but if not, I wish everyone a beautiful evening.
Did anybody look at the situation and say, okay, we've got the fertilized cells, but they can't become life unless they're nurtured in a mother's womb, and therefore